I think I asked, I think my question made it onto that tape, so we could probably just...
The question was about my work day and how it came about or went. We had three vehicles at the IVS compound, and I drove an old Land Rover.
Uh-huh.
It was a beautiful old car, aluminum, four-wheel drive, and later on it got blown up just before the Tet Offensive, but they did manage to fix it. So, but I would drive that over to the Ag Service, TNAMVU it was called, Provincial Agriculture Service, and I would meet with Mr. Kai and Mr. T, and there were about three people that I worked with there, and they would have an agenda. They usually made their agenda, and they were maybe today going out to visit some farmers in a hamlet, and it would take part of the day to get there, and they'd do their little talk on planting sugar baby watermelons or whatever, and then we would get in the boat and come back. I didn't actually, they were pretty well versed themselves in techniques, and so it wasn't that I was always there to teach them how to grow this or that. I had access to maybe more modern varieties of stuff, and I would try to get seeds for them.
Like the tomato seeds.
I felt at times I was being used by the Vietnamese as kind of a status symbol.
Okay.
We're bringing the American with us. Come and listen. Come and see.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to go beg something off of some some shopkeepers, if they were having a little contest or something and needed some prizes, they would take, quote-unquote, the American along, which probably would make the shopkeeper feel more like he had to give something. I don't know why that would be, but I felt used quite a bit. And
but those weren't bad uses.
No, not bad uses. These same people knew that I had limited PX privileges, too, with a military PX, and that I could get them Johnny Walker Red and for very cheap, and I could get cigarettes for them for very cheap, because there are no taxes, of course, on a liquor, cigarettes, what you would buy in the PX. And so I really, it irritated me a lot that I felt there were certain people that were just using me as their, they always gave me the money, and they always had U.S. dollars or MPCs, military payment certificates, which were the the only legal American money at that time in country. But they always seemed to have them, and they come with their money. You buy me whatever. And I'd say, well, and I usually didn't do it right away. I didn't want to jump and make them feel that they could work me that quickly, I guess. So, but I developed some very fairly close friendships with the Vietnamese that I worked with, and to the point of being invited into their homes in other activities other than professional. And I appreciated that. So I tried to overlook these things that I was being used and try to figure it's all going to balance out, I guess. So I would go to the Ag Service, and we'd, well, we're going out to the island in the river today to work for the farmers out there. And we'd get out there, and the farmers were always very happy to see you, and they'd always bring you tea, at least, or bananas. They always, no matter how poor they were, would bring you something.
Uh-huh.
And that was really kind of heart-wrenching at times, because you know these people living in the thatched huts with the dirt floors, and the, you know, it just, they had so little, and yet they felt that they could give you something, and that they wanted to do that. So, and it's that way around the world. Wherever I've traveled, people are that way. Mankind is basically good, I guess. So I really liked the farmers. There's a little anecdote I want to tell.
Uh-huh.
We had a farmer out on the island who was blind, and he had a huge goiter on his neck. It must have been the size of a grapefruit, only it was elongated. It hung down the side of his neck. And yet his family always had him with them And I don't know if he ever could really do any work in the fields, but he was always with them. He was part of their family, and they included him. He wasn't shut away somewhere in a room like maybe we tend to do today with people who aren't well.
Mm-hmm.
We did manage later on. We went to the American military in Kanta and arranged for him to have the goiter removed. And when I left Vietnam, we had a party, and the guy took my finger and ran it along the scar on his neck, and he said, "I will always remember you by this." And I cried. Not there, but later on when I thought about it. So
it's a very decent thing to do.
Absolutely. Though. And we tried to have something done with his eyes, but they were just too far gone with cataracts. Many, many people there had eye diseases, and children who were blind in one eye. Uh-huh. It was just a shame. Maybe something as simple as putting whatever it is they put in their eyes when the babies are born, silver or whatever that is. Yeah,
some little droppings.
Yeah, but they didn't have that available. And the diseases there were yellow fever, plague, you name it. Hepatitis. I saw IVSers with hepatitis. Their whites of their eyes were all yellow. Mary Dundas, I remember, came from Chau Duc on her way to Saigon, and she had hepatitis. I could just tell by looking at her. Her skin was kind of yellowish. And we all said, "Oh my God, you're sick." Which, of course, made her feel better.
Well, she probably knew herself.
Yeah. Well, we had one poor IVSer. He was a Cuban from Florida.
Uh-huh.
Can't remember his name. I can see him just as plain. A big, big fellow. He wasn't in Vietnam very long, and he got hepatitis so bad they had to send him home.
Mm.
And I think he did finally recover, but, ooh.
He was from Cuba?
He was a Cuban living in...
Oh, in Miami?
In Miami, okay. Miami area, yeah. So
that really would have been the International Voluntary Services.
Yes. IVS did later on live up to its international. They started hiring more people. We had Young Chung Lai from Taiwan. Mm-hmm. We had a fellow
who's in the United States somewhere.
Is he? Mm. There were other Taiwanese too. And we had some people from Japan. Canada. Jim Moore was from Canada. Jim Moore, I think, left just after I came. He had been there for his 2 years. And he went back to back home on the Russian train.
Oh, the Trans-Siberian?
He rode the Trans-Siberian Railway from Vladivostok to Moscow.
I've always wanted
and
to
we
do
couldn't
that.
Do that because we were Americans, but he was Canadian. He could get away with that. So.
What did you think about this internationalization?
Oh, I thought it was good.
Uh-huh.
First of all, it brought in more experienced people. When I go back and say 2 weeks studying tropical agriculture in the Philippines, me, a corn and soybeans boy from Minnesota,
uh-huh.
How long did it take me to learn what I was doing? And to hire experienced people from Taiwan or from Japan who knew on how to grow rice before they got there, certainly, and vegetables in the raised beds like they did there. Well, we had Filipinos too in IVS.
Mm-hmm.
That was a smart move, certainly, to pick, and I think that was a trend of the Peace Corps for a long time. They took liberal arts people by the hundreds and sent them off to remote areas, and they didn't know what they were doing. I think in both cases, IVS and the Peace Corps now, they hire experienced people in certain areas, certainly. So,
at least more than they did.
Yes, right.
Especially as the Peace Corps programs contracted.
Right.
Getting away from the huge numbers. Yes, just pause for a second.
Uh-huh. Young Chung Lai was a favorite of mine. I don't remember, he was in what town he was in the Delta. We had to write these awful monthly IVS reports every month.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to tell what you were doing and how things were going. And poor young Chung Lai did not have, at that time, a good command of the English language. And so he would agonize over these reports. And he would come into Kanta with his report, and we would work with him on it. But young Chung Lai had a habit of starting his reports out, "There is an old Chinese proverb that goes." And they were so entertaining because his experiences were always being applied to what he knew his ancestors had done, and it all fit together in his mind, and they were such a joy to read. So we helped him on his getting his English straight in his reports, and he appreciated it, and we appreciated reading the report. So it was kind of give and take thing.
Yeah. So. But no, I was curious about the internationalization. That seemed to have been, well, certainly Dan Whitfield said that he pushed it very strongly. He was very much in favor of it.
Yes. Wise move, yeah.
But it really started after the resignations, and I wondered if there was some linkage there, because you would bring in people who wouldn't have the same increasingly radical concern of the American
volunteers.
That
might be part of it too, yes.
And Dan said no, but...
IVSers in the year that after I got there, who came in groups, who had signed the contract that said we are not going there to become political critics, and yet when they got there they did. And I think in some cases they were sent home. Legally, they should have had to find their own way home, I guess, and I don't remember if IVS, you certainly can't just let somebody hang out in Saigon when it costs $1,100 to get home. But that might have been part of it, internationalizing.
Yeah, it's only speculation on my part, and the man who administered it says no, that it wasn't.
Yeah.
So I really have no basis of saying that. It was just a curiosity to me. Yeah. The controversy over the resignations.
Yes.
Because Willie Meyer was your first.
Team leader,
supervisor, whatever. And Don Luce was director when you arrived. What part did you have in any of the discussions about this move on their part? Were you approached about signing the letter?
Yes. I don't remember who approached me or how it came to me, but the letter, I received the letter and I looked at it. And I agreed with everything that was in it.
Mm-hmm.
I did not agree to the point where I felt that I could not stand it anymore to be there because of this.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I was selling myself out, but I felt that I had come this far to work with these people. And although I didn't always agree with what the policy was in Vietnam, and that we were running over a culture without regard to the people, I agreed with that. I felt I'm going to stay here and just do what I can.
Mm-hmm.
I signed the letter. And I told somebody the other day, I probably have a dossier in Washington because of that. Somewhere in the stacks.
Yeah. <Who knows? laughs> The silverfish have another little piece of meal.
Yes. They have my fingerprints, and they have probably investigated me. John Spragans was a volunteer in the Delta, I believe. John was very vocal about, was quite anti-war. And he went to Japan after he left Vietnam, and he published some fairly strong anti-Vietnamese literature, and I was on his mailing list.
You mean anti-Vietnamese or Vietnam War?
Anti-Vietnam, I'm sorry. Okay. Not anti-Vietnamese. Anti-Vietnam War. I was on his mailing list, and I remember getting mail here in Minnesota after I had come back that someone had opened up and in one case wrote some kind of communist comment on there against John. Somebody in the post office or somebody who knows where
mm-hmm.
looked at it and wrote a sarcastic comment across it. And then I thought, well, I'm probably on that list again, you know, in Washington as receiving all this.
Well, I'd say good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't worry about it.
No, I mean you don't look stressed out.
No. Right.
But I mean if you're going to let that kind of intimidation cower you, then what is democracy?
Right. That's yeah. true.
So, were there any discussions you said that you received the letter?
I don't remember how I received it.
But
whether Don came around with it, I suppose Willie Myers probably had the copy and gave us each one, and telling what they were doing, and then it appeared in the New York Times. It was a letter to President Johnson, mm-hmm. and all our 50 some names were assigned on it, and where we were from, our city, and so forth.
Your mom must have loved that.
Oh, I don't know if she ever even knew about it.
Okay.
But. And then Willie and Don and Gene Stolzfus and Don Ronk and mm-hmm. somebody That's else. Was that all of them?
Just the four.
Four left. And I just went about my business again, I guess, and kind of forgot about it. Immersed myself in my work.
Yeah, well, there were...
So I didn't feel as strongly about it as they did, although I agreed with what they said and probably did, so...
Yeah. Well, I think their strategy was just to have the four of them resign.
Yeah.
To make the political statement.
Right.
But not to destroy the organization and the potential.
Right.
So they probably would not have wanted you to resign.
And then I think, was it about that time that Arthur Gardner, who was on the head of the board, AZ we used to call him, old mm-hmm. AZ, came over there?
Mm-hmm.
Or was that another incident? Was there another incident? He came over there in quite a hurry once to talk to all the IBSers to see what was going on.
Probably that time.
Maybe that was it.
I've looked through some old newspaper clippings, and I believe that that may have been the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say that it was, but I believe it may have been.
Yeah.
And of course, Whitfield told me that, you know, he saw his first job as needing to talk to as many, if not every, volunteer possible
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
to see what they were feeling and try to give them some encouragement.
Right.
So, obvious big thing.
Yeah.
But once that had taken, once the resignations had happened, the letter was delivered, the brouhaha hit the
mm-hmm.
fan,
mm-hmm.
But then you went back to your
In my mind, that was kind of over.
Mm-hmm.
What the impact was back here, what happened to the four right after that time, I don't even remember.
Uh-huh.
But I decided in my mind, I'm just going to go about my business, and that's water over the dam, so to speak. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that letter was, let's see, I think it was dated September 19th of 1967. So you went back to work, but pretty soon you're getting into very early 1968.
Yes.
When there were bigger things that were going on. Did you have any inkling that something about Tet was going on?
Yes. Although it was some afterthought that I was on the staff, and I was traveling to some of the outposts of IVSers early... probably in December and January of 67, 68.
Uh-huh.
And some of the IVSers were saying, there's something going on.
Uh-huh.
There are bunkers being built in homes.
Uh-oh.
You know,
like the
sandbags,
old bomb shelters.
Bomb shelters. And we didn't, I guess they saw it and they didn't think any more about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then after the Tet Offensive came, then you look back and said, people knew about this, and I guess our government didn't.
Mm-hmm. Our military intelligence let us down.
I wonder why, yes. And this was at the time in Newsweek and Time magazines, you were reading about the light at the end of the tunnel. And everything was getting better. And then all of a sudden, was the Tet Offensive, and it happened at such an odd time, because I believe there was some kind of an agreement that there would be no fighting during that period of Tet, which is their big, big celebration of the year. And
well, that had been the case in every other previous year for Tet.
Yeah. And
where both sides could stand down.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so in our minds, we felt kind of home free, and we were all enjoying Tet. Mm-hmm. And everything just kind of shuts down. All the stores are closed. You better have enough food for a week, you know. And people were out visiting each other, bringing each other gifts, shooting off firecrackers. The veneration of the ancestors, the whole thing, and everybody was having a good time. And then here in the middle of the night, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's Light City and noise and
more than firecrackers.
More than firecrackers. And I said earlier that we got used to this, and we did, because we went back to sleep. But then we woke up later, and it was still going on, and it went on and on. And pretty soon, there was a knock at our door.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know what was going on, and it was Colonel Wallace. Colonel Wallace was the chief American in Kentucky, and military.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there has been an attack on the town, and he said, you better stay in. We stayed in, and we stayed in, and we had nothing to eat. And so nobody told us what was going on. This is in our own little house.
Yeah.
With Bill and Jerry and myself.
Bill had only arrived just recently.
Probably, poor guy.
I think his yellow form, I did not see him in New York City, but I think by his yellow form, he arrived something like October.
Yeah.
So he wasn't even there for the resignation.
No, hadn't been there very long. And I don't remember when it happened. Did we ended up building a bunker on the lower floor of our house out of sandbags.
Mm-hmm.
The Tet Offensive did not just happen one day. It went on for several days, and it was a coordinated attack throughout the country. Kentaw was only one. There was a lot of fighting downtown. The Vietnamese military came in with their heavy power and destroyed a few buildings where they felt there were VC holed up in them.
Mm-hmm.
There were some people killed. We got tired of waiting. I think our Vietnamese neighbor, finally invited us over for something to eat. And then we decided that we would get in the Land Rover and drive over to the IVS house. And we drove there very fast. And I don't know who was there. I can't recall. We ended up going downtown to where some of the fighting was. And I took my camera with me, and I got some pictures of that. Over the next few days, the University of Kentucky, which was right next to the IVS house, was bombed by our planes. They said there were VC hold up in there. They said that our IVS in the University of Kentucky building.
Do you think there were?
I have no idea.
Okay. You said the IVS house was close by. I thought maybe you might have known if there was.
They said that there was a VC infiltration route that went right through the university and where our house was.
Mm.
Our house ended up being destroyed, the IBS house. We weren't in it when that happened. So the fighting continued. This is the first day. The fighting continued, and we didn't know where to go. There were rumors. There was no communication. The highway number one between Kentucky and Saigon had been blown up, so there were no supplies. Over the next over the next few days, the gasoline stations ran out of gas. You have no idea what it is to live in a country where everything falls apart. We are so blessed here. The way our transportation systems are set up, how everything moves, we have everything we want when we want it and more, and what we waste. And when you live under martial law and the economy falls apart because of fighting like that, it is a real eye-opener. You can see where anarchy reigns in some countries.
Mm-hmm.
It is, it's a terrible thing. We were feeding on rumors. They said there were so many divisions of VC outside of Kanta and they were going to attack. We started thinking, what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? We were like rabbits in a trap, you know. I mean, the whole city is surrounded by rice field, and it was all controlled by the VC, so mm-hmm. they said. We ended up going out to the airport and staying with the special forces. Special forces people.
They gave you the gun?
No. Special forces people, of course, were the most trained and probably the most feared of the American military there. They gave us a place to stay. They gave me a bunk to sleep in. We ate dinner in their mess. I made the mistake of, it was very full and I had a plate of food and I was going to go sit at this table, and they said, you can't sit there, that's where the officers sit. You know? And I thought, more of this shit.
You know,
I have to get up in the morning in their hospitals and point my shoes in the right direction. And now
while you're dying.
yes, and here, you know, I would have never fit in the military.
You should have just said, turned around and said, I am an officer.
Yeah, I am, sir. That's Roger, sir. John Balaban writes very well about this period in his book, chapter 4 or whatever it is, Under Fire. John Balaban took...
Heaven's Face?
Yes.
Yeah.
John Balaban, unknowns to me, took very accurate notes every day he was there, and he wasn't in Vietnam very long. And he writes very effectively about this, about what he was thinking and what we went through. The worst thing that could have happened to me that evening was they were going to show movies. And the movie was a war movie with guts and gore in it. And I walked out. I couldn't take it anymore. Who knows, we were going to all be overrun and die. Why am I watching a war movie? And I went, and I don't think I slept probably at all that night. We did not stay there a second night. I think then that's when we hooked up with the doctors at the hospital, the Air Force doctors. We went mm-hmm. to work at the hospital as...
you and Jerry and Bill.
Jerry and Bill and I, yes. Mm-hmm. And they worked in the operating room, and I worked as an orderly, I guess you would say, taking people back and forth out of the operating room. And we saw napalm victims. We saw people with arms and legs blown off. We saw people die.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnamese hospital where we worked was very full. When someone in your family is injured, the whole family moves into the hospital. And they camp out either outside the door or they're in the hallways. You couldn't walk. There was not enough room. And we were working with some nuns also who were helping run the hospital. That was when the nuns probably were thinking, what's going to happen if we're overrun? And they sat there and made us Red Cross bands to put on our arms. I still have mine somewhere. A white cloth cotton band with a big red cross on it, and they said, wear this.
Yeah.
We felt a little bit safer probably. Well, then we made the mistake of going to see someone at the USAID compound, and that's where I was given a grease gun. Here, protect yourself, was pretty much what they were saying. And we had visions when we signed our contract that in case something like this happened, we would be evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be in an airplane going who knows where, away from this. But no.
You've got later, a grease gun
later on, we were told we didn't want to run because the Vietnamese would feel that we weren't standing by them. So here I was with a Red Cross band on one arm and a grease gun in the other. And I happened to run into somebody from the Red Cross, and they said, "You cannot do this. You have to make your choice. Are you going to wear this Red Cross, or are you going to carry the gun? You cannot do both."
Right.
And so I think I took the gun apart and put it in a handbag and carried it that way or something. It wasn't visible.
Yeah.
Anyway, getting back to my house and my little bed at the end of the stairs, upstairs, when I ended up later on putting the grease gun underneath the bed and imagining Viet Cong ripping the door open and coming down the steps and me shooting at them with a blaze of fire and the thing I'd never shot before in my life, but somebody said, "This is what you do," and them falling down the steps dead, you know. This is not a conducive place to do volunteer work.
Yeah. Kind of cuts down on the agriculture extension of effectivity, doesn't it?
Yeah. We worked at the hospital, I think, for about 4 or 5 days. And then we went to Saigon. We couldn't get out of Kantab because there was no space. All the military activity that was going on during the Tet Offensive, there was no room for people like us to go to be running around the country.
No.
So we did finally get a plane, and we went to Saigon. We stayed at the IBS house, which...
By Thompson.
Yes, and it was very... you could hear... I remember there was all kinds of fighting going on over in Cholun, the sister mm-hmm. city.
The Chinese support.
I have pictures of a sunset looking off to the west toward Cambodia, and then there's smoke rising up around the sun as it's setting. It was just... We linked up with a youth group, I think, in Saigon, and we helped deliver rice. We had a couple trucks. These 100-kilo bags.
Yeah,
220 pounds.
Yeah. Heavy suckers.
Well, yes, yes, and these little wiry Vietnamese loading them on their backs and trundling off with them. I never lifted one, I know, but I helped drive the vehicle. After several days, we found out that it was probably safe to go back to Kantah. We didn't know what to expect. We thought maybe there had been a fire in Kantah and a part of the town had burned.
Yeah.
That was combustible, made up of the shacks and so forth, made out of thatch. And the Vietnamese military had taken over our IVS house. They were there. They plundered pretty much everything of value that was in the house. I didn't lose anything of any value. Our house where Jerry and Bill and I lived was okay. And we continued to live there. Then IVS had to make some decisions as to which sites to close. And then that's when I got involved in helping close down some of the stations. And I traveled here and there to do that.
This is where one of my questions fits in.
Yes.
That I had looked over your yellow sheet. And you described yourself as staff position, ag specialist for Region 4. And I wasn't sure exactly what that was. I thought it sounded to me like it might have been agriculture team leader.
Yes.
Okay.
I believe there were four agriculture team leaders.
Okay, yeah. One for each of the zones.
One for each zone, and I was in zone 4.
Okay.
4 Corps, they called it.
Yeah, because the fellow I mentioned before, Steve Swift, mm-hmm. he was up in the I Corps.
I Corps.
If that included Dalat, would that have included?
I'm not sure.
Then
not
he sure. might have been in 2 Corps.
Corps, possibly.
Because that's where he and Sabina
Quay
first
would
met.
Have been in I Corps.
In I Corps.
Yeah.
Yeah, he described himself as having... He might have actually handled two different corps at one time.
Could be.
He might have done first and second.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I was wondering about that title.
When I got the position, the amount of money I was paid went from $80 a month to $250.
Whoa.
And so beyond that, I was getting Vietnamese piastres for living expenses. Mm-hmm. My housing was paid for. So this $250, I was just salting away.
Yeah, that's
and over a period of 12 months, you got $3,000 there. So mm-hmm. when I came back, being a poor college student when I left, I didn't really have very much money, and so that helped me a lot to have that done.
Yeah,
or to get that money.
You were this team leader from when to when?
It would have been the second year that I was there.
Starting in the beginning of the second year, so about July.
I came there in July of '66.
Yeah, so
I suppose somewhere in the middle of 67 maybe mm-hmm. that happened. I can't recall really.
All right. Yeah.
So, where am I?
Well, you were describing the need to cut back after the Tet Offensive and the
yes.
order going out to you as well.
They decided to close certain stations, and I don't know how they did that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe through the military. Reports on where it was safe and where it wasn't, and so,
uh-huh.
and there were IVSers who decided they wanted to leave immediately, and they made that request and they were let to go home.
Did Whitfield or anyone else consult with you about what volunteers would be best?
No,
not ordered, but maybe encouraged to leave home.
No,
or which,
no,
okay.
no. Those decisions were made above. In Saigon.
Okay.
So.
And by the volunteers themselves, if they want to
yes,
go.
Yes, yes.
Of course.
In the meantime, my parents are sitting at home watching the evening news and seeing all, and then the incident with the policeman shooting the guy in the
yes,
head,
yes.
General Luan, all this terrible stuff every night when you're eating dinner. And I got a letter from my mother saying, they can't keep you there, can they? IVS.
Right.
You know, she didn't come out and say, why aren't you coming home? Why haven't you made the decision to come home? She didn't come out and ask that. I don't know, I was 26, 27 years old, and I was still kind of foolhardy, and I was all making it through this, and I particularly, I guess when my car or my Land Rover was blown up, I had some second thoughts about, was I on a list? Why did this happen to me? Am I marked? But I don't know, beyond it, I had this idea. I wanted to stay the 2 years and I was going to make it through.
Mm-hmm.
And it, when I wasn't getting any work done in March, I couldn't get out in the field. I was trying to busy myself with stuff around Kanta. The refugee camps were coming up, but there were a lot of groups there helping. Other groups.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt kind of useless, I guess. I was helping close down some of the stations. I could get that done. But I didn't see any point in staying any longer because I couldn't do any work. And so I requested that I leave, and they said fine. And so I left on the 15th of April. And
mm-hmm.
I took about a month to go home.
Yeah.
And I went to Cambodia, and did I go to Taiwan that time? I don't recall anymore what I did on the way home. I ended up in Hawaii, I guess, laying on the beach a while. And I got home, my sister said, she looked at me and she said, you look like you're from a different race. No, that wasn't her exact words, but I was very tan,
mm-hmm.
and I don't tan easily. I'm a very light-complected person. But living in a climate like that for almost 2 years, and you're out in the sun every day.
And you're observing rays in Honolulu.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, and I did in Honolulu on the beach, too.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I was also very thin. That was one of the first things my mother mentioned, and I had had...
Mothers will always
mention. I had encephalitis, I'd lost weight, and I had some of these other digestive things, so I was kind of skinny.
Mm-hmm.
And so she wanted to fatten me up, I guess, a little bit. And
Could
but I had I had dreams. I didn't have really nightmares. I had dreams that were frightening for almost probably a year.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be out on a canal in a boat, and the Viet Cong were after me, and they were capturing me, and somehow I always knew to wake up. I could almost control that I could wake up. And I don't have those anymore. The whole experience, I think, in Vietnam was good for me. And there might be some awful things that I have said or related that sound kind of scary, but at the time I was young, I probably would not do it again. Now that I'm older and more sensible or wiser, I don't know. I valued my IVS experience, certainly. And that's why I continue to give money to the organization and go to their events that they have in Washington every so
mm-hmm.
often.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep in contact with some other IVSers. I know that I've been responsible for recruiting other IVSers. A Joyce Batcher, for example.
Oh, really?
There was...
You knew her?
I knew her in college.
Oh.
She and her husband both went to the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
There was a gentleman by the name of Daryl Leopold, who was a roommate of mine, who was in the Peace Corps and later went into IVS in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
He has since died of AIDS.
Mm.
But so I was responsible for his. There were other people that joined the Peace Corps. I had another roommate who went to Columbia in the Peace Corps. The gentleman I mentioned about the Purple Burps who went, he and his wife, I know, went there because of the experiences that I related. So I kind of like to think I was responsible for maybe 10 or so people getting out and having kind of the same experience I did. And in most cases, it was a pleasant experience.
Yeah, Vietnam, of course, was so unique.
Was different and unique, and will never happen anywhere again. But
we hope.
Yeah. So that's kind of nice to have in the back of your mind, I guess.
Too. Yeah, yeah. So. Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Yes.
I was tucking away. I did interject a few times, but I had some others. I was really intrigued when I read your yellow form that you returned about the pipe bomb on the Jeep, and you mentioned it a couple of times.
Yeah, yeah.
When exactly did that
this
happen?
This happened about 3 weeks before the Tet Offensive. And who knows, maybe it was somewhat connected. It's a complicated little story because it involves Ted Kennedy,
all right,
of all people, who was on... Ted Kennedy was on a refugee committee of some sort in Washington.
He was the chairman of
Yes, and had come to Vietnam to check out the camps. All these people came over there, and we always laughed. Sometimes we had to meet them. Sometimes I had to stay in from going out and visiting the farmers because there was a senator in town
mm-hmm.
looking at the country. Traveling around with the military who were showing him how wonderful everything was going with the war. And it made us sick sometimes. It was a waste of our time. But Kennedy was there, and he was working with refugees, and we thought, well, that's okay.
That's better
Kennedy,
than, yeah.
Yeah, Kennedy was scheduled to come and meet with us at the main IVS house in Kanta one evening after supper, 6 o'clock, we usually ate. And he was supposed to be there at 6:30 or 7 after we ate. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know where he was coming from or how he was going to get there even. Roger Montgomery was our team leader at the time. And I don't know if Roger was going to go meet him or how he was going to get to our house. We had just finished eating our evening meal at the IVS house.
Weren't you team leader?
No. Roger Montgomery was.
But I thought you were made a team leader in... the middle of 67.
Agriculture. No. That's a different side shoot.
Oh.
It has nothing to do with regular team leaders. I was sort of responsible in agriculture in seeing that the people in the Delta were getting what they needed and maybe giving them some tips on what they could be doing if they maybe weren't doing very much. Some people
yeah.
came there and didn't do very much.
Mm-hmm.
Urge them a little bit, you know.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt, but I thought
okay.
you might have both been at the same time in the
yeah.
same place, and I was wondering what that was.
Anyway, we had finished our meal, probably hadn't gotten up from the table yet, and there was an explosion outside. Of course, we ran out the door. We had an international scout there, and came around the side, and the doors were blown open, and probably the glass was out, and there had been a bomb underneath the car, and it had exploded, and there was a hole. It was hot ground there was very hard and had crushed rock and whatnot in it, but it had blown a hole in the ground and blown a hole in the bottom of the vehicle. When something like that happens, it draws a crowd of people. And the Vietnamese came to see what, the passing Vietnamese outside in the street came to see what was going on. In addition, there was a public television set outside our house on a tall, maybe 20-foot rack type thing. And that came on about that time in the evening, and people didn't have television sets, and they came to watch the propaganda from the government, I guess you might call it. And they were starting to gather. So there were people already there, and then other people came running to see. Well, because this bomb went off and it was very close to the TV set, some people had been wounded.
Oh.
And yeah. so my Land Rover was out in the street, and my first intuition, I guess, was to jump in the Land Rover and back up to where these wounded people were and take them to the hospital.
Right.
Which was only 3 or 4 blocks away. This is the hospital we worked at later on during
yeah.
the Tet Offensive.
Mm-hmm.
I jumped in the Land Rover, started it. I may have had it in reverse already, and something went through my mind. What if there's a mine under this one? And this had happened before, I guess. But I wasn't the only one who had thought about this. Our neighbor had thought this too before I did, and he was actually down looking underneath my vehicle, and he saw something, and he was shouting, "Mean, mean," which is French, I suppose, for mine, and it registered. And this all happened just in an instant, and I was starting to doubt what was going on, and he was looking, and he was shouting, "Mean, mean." And so I put the car back into neutral and put on the brake and jumped out of the car. And I don't know what happened in the meantime to the wounded people. I can't recall.
Yeah.
Somebody else must have come and taken them away. I don't know. Anyway, we ran down the street to tell people to stay away. We also had somebody go to the American military where we could get bomb people
yeah.
who could do something about the bomb. But in about 5 minutes, the bomb went off. There was a dog killed. There was a dog, I think, sniffing around the area. I don't know whether the dog set it off or if it was a pressure mine. Had I backed up, my right front tire would have gone over the mine and would have set it off. But, of course, I wasn't in there, and it blew all the tires flat. The glass out of the windshield, it blew. The thing was stuffed with bicycle ball bearings. They all went up through the seat, blew the seat out, and went and shot holes through the roof. I can only imagine, but had I been in there, had I not been killed, I probably would have lost my right arm and leg. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just from the concussion of the thing. It
so
was no small bomb.
So this is two bombs.
There were two bombs.
The one
went off first. People gathered. Second one went off.
Yeah.
And
so you would not have been specifically targeted. Seems like they were putting
the bombs.
Well, the
thing, getting
on,
back to the Kennedy thing.
On all of the vehicles.
Yeah.
Just any IVS vehicle.
Yeah.
Why? Because Kennedy
Why
was
did
coming?
This happen on the night that Kennedy was supposed to
of
come?
Of all nights.
Why?
Yeah.
You wonder, was Kennedy targeted?
Mm-hmm.
Was it a coincidence? Did maybe somebody didn't know? I think not.
I think not, yeah.
Kennedy evidently does not remember this ever happening. He has been asked about it. We know about Edward Kennedy. He's probably
yeah.
drunk out of his mind. But anyway, he did not show up. He was delayed at a refugee camp or something.
Yeah.
And I think Roger Montgomery probably went and met with him the next day or 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
And then, right very soon, was Dave Gettleson's death.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was the Tet Offensive. The bombing of the car, Dave Gettleson's...
The cars.
Dave Gettleson's death, and the Tet Offensive all happened, I think, within a period of 3 weeks.
Well, Gettleson, to tie him in more closely with these two bombs, he had been meeting with Kennedy. Had he
so
not?
So that was happening at the same time. Okay. Okay.
I mean, I think that's what I've heard, right?
Yes.
That he had been meeting with Kennedy and helping him with
and there is a little twist in why Dave Gettleson was killed,
uh-huh.
or why he was targeted. Did this have something to do with Kennedy? Was he killed because he was in the way of plans for the Tet Offensive?
That rumor is there too.
There are rumors that
he might
our
have
own
seen
government
something.
Had him killed.
That our own government, yes.
That the Vietnamese government had him killed. That it was not just VC coming and doing away with Dave Gettleson, who was
actually,
the poor American, the Vietnamese called him, and he had respect amongst the Vietnamese.
And also, to throw this out, maybe either the American government or the Vietnamese government put the bombs in your Jeep because they didn't want you meeting with Kennedy.
Who knows?
Because the VC would have wanted you to meet with Kennedy because you would have given him information that the military never would have.
Yes, who knows?
Or at least impressions, if not information.
Of all the events, of course, I think that happened to me that in Vietnam, mm-hmm. that one, the vehicles being mined, made me lay awake at night more than anything else because I wondered, and I have never known, why this happened then. Was this personal for me? Was somebody out to get me? Would this something happen later on?
Mm-hmm.
After a while, I guess maybe I kind of softened on it, and I didn't try not to think about it. I certainly didn't write this home to my parents.
No.
And they didn't know about it until I started showing pictures. When I got home, I showed slides, and there was my mined car.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a little vial. I'll show it to you later. Of pieces of pipe bomb and ball bearings that I picked up at the site.
I think we would probably want a picture of the mined car.
I have one of those. Yeah.
Even without seeing it, yeah. I'm pretty sure yeah. that would be yeah. worth noticing or worth having.
So, I guess from maybe the 15th of January until when I left in April, we really didn't get very much done.
2+ months.
Yeah, because of the Tet Offensive and because of what was going on with Gettleson and the bombings.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a nice Christmas. We spent Christmas up at Baulach, which is up in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And IVSers came there from all around, and it was a good time. We had Hawaiians in our group who did a pig roast, and it was just really fun and nice.
Yeah.
And I remember on Christmas Eve, there were services at a little church right near where we were. We were staying in a school or a dormitory or whatever. And it was very cold. I remember cold, and there were
yeah.
not enough blankets because it was up in the mountains and it was in December.
And now you were physically a...
Yes, adjusted.
Adjusted.
Tropical person, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't just the Vietnamese who were wearing sweaters.
And we drank lots of strawberry wine. They had strawberry wine up there from Dalat. And
uh-huh.
So that was kind of good. I have pictures of us drinking strawberry wine on the runway. There was a strike, Air America strike, and so we were delayed getting out of there.
My God, a strike against the CIA.
Yes, how about that? I think it was some of the like Filipino workers or whoever.
Uh-huh. The maintenance
who
workers.
Who did that, maintenance workers. So.
Yeah.
And then when you get back from an event like that, it takes you several days just to kind of get back in the swing of things. When you went on vacation, I remember going to Singapore and seeing a modern city, and I ate ice cream and things that I hadn't done, drank milk. I did not drink milk in Vietnam. There was no milk to be had. I'm not a big milk drinker, but you know, these are things that you miss. Butter. We didn't eat that stuff. We ate rice and vegetables. And, you know. So going to Singapore, and you kind of gorge yourself on these things, and you kind of go into a different world, and then you come back to Vietnam, and things just aren't going well, and you get depressed, and you think, what am I doing here? Am I ever going to get anywhere? You know, and it took a while, especially when you went on vacation out of country, to get back into the swing of things.
Should IVS have completely closed down after TEP?
No, I don't think so. I think the education people probably would be safe. Agriculture and community development, that's kind of iffy there, because you got to travel out.
Yeah. So maybe that?
Yeah, they pared back, and I don't recall who left and who stayed. And I know there were more volunteers came later. So, and I don't know who they were or what they were doing there.
Yeah.
So.
No, I was just thinking, because you saw the worst of the war right up close. And
yes.
Never got any worse than that. But on the other hand, it set the tone for everything that was later to come. And by making the ability to do anything so impossible, I just wonder if it would have been better for the volunteers in the organization to simply move on to another country. Tell AID, this is it, we can't do it.
Yeah. I don't recall the financial connections with USAID or IVS was trying to get away from the apron strings of them.
Yeah.
And purse strings. And that was some of the argument amongst IVSers too. Why are we connected with USAID? Why can't we do it on our own?
And, yeah.
We had privileges there because of USAID. We had military, some limited military privileges. We could get on R&R flights. We had PX privileges. We were paid in military payment certificates a few every month. Some IVSers resented that and refused it.
Refused the government money?
Though they didn't have anything to do with those particular items. They didn't want it. They had principles.
Money.
They
yeah,
had principles.
Yeah.
And I would guess Dave Gettleson may have been one of those.
Probably.
He's a very principled person. So, I don't know what the history is after I left. We got away from USAID, I know that.
Well, I just see this complete breakdown in all of your activities.
Yeah.
And it just seems like the obvious thing would be just to cut and run. To say, well,
that's it.
You know, we started in 57 with a wonderful agriculture program, but then things were possible, now they're impossible. So it's only a speculative question.
Right.
And a kind of policy concern. From your yellow form, you mentioned at one point that travel in the, quote, borderline safe areas was impossible for you. Was impossible. Or let's say not possible. Maybe I should have figured out which particular question that came from. Let me find the place. There. This is in question 4, was the Viet Cong present in your assignment? You say moderate, in quotes, at first. Dash. Sometimes travel with the ag service persons.
Yes.
Was not possible for me because they would be traveling into borderline safe areas.
The ag service people were able to travel in areas where there was probably VC infiltration and the VC would not bother them. But if I had been with them, there may have been a problem.
For them or for you?
For them and for me.
For all,
yes,
all of you.
All
okay.
Concerned. So some days I would go to the ag service and they would say, we're going out to such and such a village or hamlet today.
And you're not.
But we don't feel it's safe. And there was this grapevine throughout Vietnam. People knew people who knew people, and some were on one side and some were on the other, and you knew what they knew what was going on behind the scenes, I think, a lot of the time when we didn't.
Yeah.
And so I just took their word at that, and I thought, well, okay.
Yeah.
And then on days like that, I would go to the ag school, which was on the edge of town, and maybe work on some of the experimental plots or visit with the teachers there or whatever. And so I always kept fairly busy, and I had things to do, even though maybe I couldn't travel with them. So.
Yeah, I was just, when reading this, I wasn't sure if you meant that it would be...
What was a real eye-opener to me, and I didn't realize what I was getting into when I was taken to Kanta from Metaw after language training, an IVSer who was already there took us on a drive out into the countryside in the afternoon, and we headed west out of Kanta, and it got to be around 4 o'clock, and he said matter-of-factly, we better get home. It's not safe to be out here after dark.
This is when you first arrived.
This is my first day or two in
Kanta. Okay. Yeah.
And I thought, oh, really? No. Ooh.
Ooh.
What else have I not heard about
here? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, you see, if you had read Graham Greene's The Quiet American, you would have known that already. Hadn't been safe since French times.
Yes, yes,
you know.
Yes.
You also mentioned that the Vietnamese, that is, your co-workers and such, were suspicious that you might be CIA and that you learned this later. When did you learn
I found that out after the letter to President Johnson.
Because the resignation letter.
The resignation letter, because it not only appeared in the New York Times, there was a write-up about it in the Vietnamese newspaper, Vietnamese language newspaper, and a couple of the teachers who I had been working with, what I thought quite successfully, came after they had read the article and almost confessed, saying, we thought you and Jerry were with the CIA.